Welcome to this week's edition of Flashback Friday, your opportunity to get some good review by listening to episodes from the past that Jason has handpicked to help you today in the present and propel you into the future. Enjoy.
Welcome to the Holistic Survival Show with Jason Hartman. The economic storm brewing around the world is set to spill into all aspects of our lives. Are you prepared? Where are you going to turn for the critical life skills necessary to survive and prosper? The Holistic Survival Show is your family's insurance for a better life. Jason will teach you to think independently, to understand threats, and how to create the ultimate action plan. Sudden change or worst case scenario, you'll be ready. Welcome to Holistic Survival, your key resource for protecting the people, places, and profits you care about in uncertain times. Ladies and gentlemen, your host, Jason Hartman.
Welcome to the Holistic Survival Show. This is your host, Jason Hartman, where we talk about protecting the people, places, and profits you care about in these uncertain times. We have a great interview for you today, and we will be back with that in less than 60 seconds on the Holistic Survival Show. And by the way, be sure to visit our website at holisticsurvival.com. You can subscribe to our blog, which is totally free, has loads of great information, and there's just a lot of good content for you on the site. So make sure you take advantage of that at holisticsurvival.com. We'll be right back.
What's great about the shows you'll find on jasonhartman.com is that if you want to learn about investing in and managing income properties for college students, there's a show for that. If you want to learn how to get noticed online and in social media, there's a show for that. If you want to know how to save on life's largest expense, there's a show for that. And if you'd like to know about America's crime of the century, there's even a show for that. Yep, there's a show for just about anything. Only from jasonhartman.com. Or type in Jason Hartman in the iTunes store.
It's my pleasure to welcome James Dellingpole to the show. He's a columnist at The Telegraph and a columnist at The Spectator, a broadcaster for Ricochet.com, and author of, and you're going to love this title, wait for it, The Little Green Book of Eco-Fascism. I love that title.
Thank
James,
you, Jason.
James, welcome. How are you?
I'm very well. Yeah, you love the title, but funnily enough, the greenies don't like the title.
Well, of course they don't like the title.
They think I'm toxic, and of course they hate being told they're fascists. They think that the fascism is a movement of the evil right, which actually I dispute, by the way.
No, fascism is a movement of the left.
You've read liberal fascism too. I can tell.
I mean, that's what it is. You know, that people confuse these things, but yeah, it's amazing. I mean, the environmental movement—they just want to control every aspect of our lives. And I just give you one example, which you're surely aware, James. But I recently moved, and my new home was filled with these CFL light bulbs, which I hate. So I went to the hardware store to buy some new bulbs, and the whole aisle is flooded with those things nowadays, those dangerous, toxic little light bulbs.
With mercury. You've seen that photograph on the internet of the wounds that they can inflict when you, if you accidentally tread on one. It's hideous.
Yeah. Don't break one of those things without calling a hazmat crew. But and they said that within a year, there will be no more incandescent light bulbs. Bush and Obama have just basically done away with them. And the cost was enormous. To buy four of them, U.S., it was $11. I remember when that was like $3.
Well, weirdly enough, there is actually a section in my book on, under I, incandescent light bulbs. Can I read it to you? And then you'll give it gives you a flavor of the book and where I'm coming from.
Yeah, absolutely. But so the listeners know, we're going to talk about a lot more than this. So.
Absolutely. I don't want to bore them.
We'll get to that in a moment. Talk about the light bulbs for a second.
Yeah, okay. So incandescent light bulbs. I liked incandescent light bulbs. They were warm, they were bright, they didn't flicker, they didn't give you headaches, they didn't take 5 hours to get going after you turned on the light switch, they didn't require you to put on a Hazchem suit if ever you accidentally broke one, and best of all, they let you see what you were doing. Not so the grim, low-energy eco bulbs, which we're all forced to use now, whether we like it or not. whatever happened to freedom of choice? Isn't that how traditionally we determine these issues in the capitalist West? We give the consumer a range of options, say, nice, bright, cheap light bulbs on the one hand, ugly, expensive, deadly ones full of mercury on the other, and then let the consumer decide. And it goes on like that.
Yeah,
but
absolutely.
This is it. I can tell that you're a man of a fellow libertarian persuasion, and this is ultimately why I'm interested in environmentalism, why I've spent so much of my time studying it, because I'm very much a small government and big personal freedom kind of guy, and what I see going on in the world right now is a world on the brink of a precipice, and it's uncertain which way it's going to go. It could go the way I'd like it to go, which is more freedom, smaller government, lower taxes, etc., etc. Or it could go the way it seems to be going at the moment, which is more regulation, one world government, this new world order that you keep reading about in various green documents. And that frightens me. And I think people need to be warned about it, not in a kind of kooky, crazy, conspiracy theorist way, but actually looking at what these guys are saying, look at what is happening in the real world right now at the United Nations, at the, in the European Union, in the regulations passed by the EPA, in the Obama administration generally. And what we see is green issues being used as an excuse for a kind of totalitarian control.
Well, there's an old saying about that, green trees have red roots. meaning in communism, for those who didn't catch that.
No, my previous book, which I thought was going to be my last word on environmentalism, because I thought I'd said it all, was a book called Watermelons, obviously green on the outside, red on the inside. And the reason I Watermelons dealt with the history of climate change alarmism, and it examined the background to the green movement and why it is that the real reasons why we had this climate change scare, and you can trace it back, for example, to the greenest government ever, which was of course Adolf Hitler's. You had the first Clean Air Acts being passed in Nazi Germany. The Germans were big. The Nazi Germans were big nature lovers. Goebbels, Himmler. Himmler was.
It's funny that they never thought people were part of nature, I guess. Or at least not certain types of people, gays, Jews, gypsies, you know.
You're absolutely right, and you make a good point that there is running through the green movement a strain of vicious misanthropy. In fact, one of the more controversial points I make, and I've made several times actually, just because they hate it so much, the enemy. You look at Rachel Carson's 1962 bestseller that launched 1,000 Greenies, including Al Gore, Silent Spring. Silent Spring was responsible for the virtual banning of DDT around the world. In other words, the most effective killer of malarial mosquitoes. And so this caring environmentalist, Rachel Carson, condemned millions of people to a miserable, painful death, which they needn't have experienced if DDT hadn't been banned effectively on her say-so. And I say the only difference between Rachel Carson and Adolf Hitler was that Adolf Hitler was slightly more upfront about the need to control the world's population and how he was going to do it. The Greenies, the modern Greenies do it through the back door, but they're not significantly less dangerous in their hatred of mankind.
Very interesting. Well, give us some examples of how the green movement, how it obstructs business.
Oh.
I mean, where do you start? I know the list is rather long.
Where do you start? Well, I suppose, let me make a more general point, which is that I said that the green movement was motivated by misanthropy. You think of phrases like the earth has a cancer, the cancer is man. That's a phrase from the Club of Rome, this greeny organization from the 1960s. But as well as this misanthropy, there is a strong vein of anti-capitalism. These guys really want to bring down Western industrial civilization. And the reason they do that is that they think that economic growth is in and of itself a bad thing. Because, of course, as we know, economic growth involves depletion of these things they call scarce resources. And built into the green religion is the idea that we are running out of stuff. We're running out of oil. We're running out of coal. We're running out of everything. And the only way of helping future generations, there's another phrase they use all the time, the only way of caring for future generations is by essentially bringing the industrial system to a close, by forcing us to ration goods. Well, there's no evidence to support this idea that we are running out of resources. Of course, resources do get depleted, but ultimately...
But new resources are created and new systems are created that use different resources. And Malthus would be, you know, this considered this incredible thinker by all of the world if he were right. The fact is he was terribly wrong. I mean, this whole Malthusian ethic is just, it's just ridiculous.
Yeah. And you go through history and you find that throughout the ages... great men of the time believed that we were running out of stuff. So you had Lord Kelvin at the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century, worrying that we'd soon reached peak coal and that soon we were going to have to abandon steamships and stuff and go back to the age of sail because there wasn't going to be enough coal. And then you look, had you gone into any major city at the turn of the 19th, 20th century, you would have found earnest committees meeting to discuss how to solve the gravest industrial problem of the age, which was, of course, how to deal with the piles of horse manure that were building up in cities all over the world because, of course, cabs were pulled by horses, transport was pulled by horses. Well, hey, how did they solve this problem? Did government step in to ration the use of horses, as probably greenies would argue? Well, no. Man, in his ingenuity, devised a new way of solving this problem called... the internal combustion engine. So suddenly the horse manure problem ceased to be a problem. Suddenly the peak coal problem ceased to be a problem. Instead, we had oil. And oil worked wonders for a time and still until we started getting these theorists. And this began quite early on in the age of petroleum, where people started worrying about peak oil. There have been about 5 peak oils, I think, where we were told that the oil's running out. Well, the oil is still going strong. We're discovering new stuff all the time in the deep of the Arctic and so on. After that, we've got clathrates, these concentrated methane deposits under the ocean. We've got shale gas, for heaven's sake. Shale gas has transformed the U.S. energy economy. We've got thorium. We haven't even begun to exploit our thorium resources yet. So scarce resources ain't a problem.
I would agree. There's always something new. But, you know, the question is, will there ever be a time, which none of us know, when the jig will be up, when maybe we won't have a solution, when there won't be a new invention or a new innovation or some ingenuity that gets us out of a pickle? And, I mean, it's just a fair question to ask. So far, yes. We've done pretty darn well, I'd say, in developing the world and taming nature and making things work pretty well. And we are conscientious about species extinction and things like this.
Which is a myth, by the way.
Tell us about that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great urban myth. Let's not forget that the global warming, the whole anthropogenic global warming scare, is just one theater of operations in a major war that the environmental movement is conducting on Western civilization. They've got all sorts of other areas. And sustainability and biodiversity are other ones. The idea that species are dropping dead because of man's wanton selfishness and greed is an absolute myth, which is created by this, I think it's a pseudoscience, really. Ecology, the whole field of ecology was invented by greenies to justify more regulation, justify these supposed experts going out into the field and sequestering these particular zones to protect nature from man's depredation. And you hear some scary figures quoted. One conservation biologist said 27,000 species are being eradicated every year, going extinct every year. And another conservation biologist said, "I'll see your 27,000 and I'll raise you to 40,000 species a year." And these figures are just plucked from the air. The number of species which have actually provably gone extinct in the last 500 years, it's vanishingly small compared with the figures that are quoted by the greenies.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. Is there any good that comes from the green movement? Let's just try to be objective here.
I do nothing but be objective.
Awareness, just general awareness in general. Is it right to conserve at all? Or we shouldn't just be wantonly wasteful, right?
No, not at all. But I think that conservatives make the best conservationists, not liberals.
Tell us about that. What do you mean by
that? Well, it's interesting. As you can probably guess by my accent, I'm English. I love the English countryside, and when I look at the English landscape, I see a landscape which has not been ravaged by man, but which has been shaped to even perfected by man. Had you gone to Britain, 2,000 years ago, you would have found the whole place covered in forest. Well, obviously, most of that forest is gone. But what you look at, the beauty of the English landscape is a landscape shaped for man's delectation and use. So, for example, you get dry stone walls in parts of the country. And the reason we have dry stone walls is partly, of course, to enclose animals, but it's partly because English country folk, particularly the landowning types, did not want barbed wire fences. And the reason they didn't want barbed wire fences is because they wanted attractive walls that their horses could jump over while fox hunting. Now, also what you find in the English landscape is lots of little woods dotted all over the place. These woods were put there in order that pheasants could be reared for shooting. If you go to Scotland, you look at the hills, and the hills look like patchwork quilts of browns and yellows and purples. And the reason they look that way is because each year different sections of the heather are burned by the gamekeepers in order to create the young shoots that the grouse need to feed on. Grouse obviously maintained for shooting. Now, it's interesting, some studies have been done comparing land which is managed by landowners for game shooting and so on, and land which is run by conservation bodies like our Royal Society for the Preservation of Birds. And there is actually greater biodiversity on the game estates than there is on the land managed by the environmentalists. And the reason for this is very simple, that environmentalists have this aversion to controlling populations of species. And what happens when you don't control different species is that one species comes to dominate. And this is a fundamental problem with the ecological view of the world.
Well, and look at the great example of this is the deer population on the eastern states of the U.S. I mean, it's just out of control, which has caused the tick population to be out of control, which is now causing a Lyme disease problem. And because this is exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And another thing that you're talking about is just the general concept of if people care for things that they have a vested interest in, they care for things that they own. And so it's kind of the tragedy of the commons, right? When it's everybody's, it's really nobody's because nobody really cares because it's all someone else's job. But if you own the land, you're going to take care of your land. Now that is certainly true in concept, and it's been true in practice. If you look at, I remember reading a Greenpeace magazine after the fall of the Soviet Union, and in the early 90s, there was just expose after expose about just the massive amounts of pollution, and this is what you get when the government controls the land rather than private ownership. You know, nobody cares. It's nobody's land. It's just, it's everybody's, so it's nobody's, if you will. But with that said, and I'm sure we agree on those things, there are certain externalities. The problem of externalities, which is the concept of if you own a manufacturing plant or you have a business, you care about making your widgets, and who cares if you pollute the river? It's not your river. You know, it's like there are externalities that are not priced in, and capitalism doesn't always do a good job. I think capitalism is massively imperfect. I just think it's better than everything we figured out so far. But there are issues. It's not like it's a perfect solution. So maybe talk to that a little bit if you would.
Where does the worst pollution happen in the world? Well, it happened in the 20th century, mainly behind the Iron Curtain. Where does it happen now? It happens in third world countries. It happens in China to a degree. I think if you look at the record of the environmental record of free market economies, they are pretty good. We have clean air regulations. I have my doubts whether this stuff wouldn't have happened anyway. And this is one of the points that Julian Simon made. You know Julian Simon, the doomslayer, as he was known. So Julian Simon was once in a debate in London, I believe, and some lefty environmentalist was showing how industrial pollution in the city had declined since the introduction of the Clean Air Act. And so what Simon did was he whipped out a chart going way, way further back and showed that when you looked at the totality of history, the Clean Air Act was barely a blip, that pollution was reducing anyway. I think one of the great liberal, greeny liberal myths is the idea, and I consider myself a classical liberal, I'm definitely not a liberal liberal. One of the great greeny myths is the idea that the world divides into two kinds of people: environmentalists on the one hand, who care about nature and want to save the planet, and on the other, evil capitalists who want to destroy it. Well, I know lots of evil capitalists, and I have to say, they take their kids to the beach, they don't think, you know, what would improve that beach? What it really needs right now is a nice juicy oil slick with maybe a few sea otters choking in tar. Nobody thinks that way. We all want a cleaner planet. I don't buy into this idea that businesses want to rape the land and pollute places. We have pollution laws in place. And look, just giving an English example again, the River Thames, for example, the river that flows through London, is infinitely cleaner than it was 300 years ago. We have been making progress, and I think that economic growth goes hand in hand with improved environmental safety. Because what happens is that as people get richer, so they have more money to set aside on making things cleaner and nicer.
Yeah, very good points, very good points. The imbalance comes when, you know, let's take an example, and we'll get off of this in a moment. I know we've got more to discuss, but on that externality concept, if you will, if Dow Chemical wants to set up a plant and manufacture something, and there is waste involved, and they got to figure out, what do we do with the waste? We got to put it somewhere. So it's really cheap for them to maybe buy a big piece of land next door and just dump it there. Even though it's their land, they own it, but they make a decision that we're just going to put it there because it was cheaper to buy the land than to do anything more proper with the waste. I'm not an expert on this, how you dispose of waste, but conceptually that's the idea. So that's where capitalism is sort of, it doesn't always work. And I am a hardcore capitalist, but you know, I just don't know how to answer that question. If I was in a debate with a leftist who was a greenie, and you know, I wouldn't know what to say to them.
Well, I think I have your solution for you, and we haven't got time to discuss this on the show now. But just look up Ronald Coase on the internet. That's Ronald, and then Coase. And he was an economist. He died recently, aged I think over 100. He dealt with this externality issue, which of course was a favorite of Barry Commoner. Barry Commoner was your typical green sort of junk economist. I don't buy into this stuff. I understand your concerns, but I think actually the problem goes the other way.
No, fair enough. Yeah,
the guys who are doing the damage right now are the environmentalists. And I give you an American example. the way that the Pacific Northwest forestry industry has been closed down by the greenies in the name of preserving this mythical creature called the spotted owl. And when I talk about the spotted owl being a mythical creature, I know the spotted owl exists, but the real spotted owl differs markedly from the creature of the green imagination. The creature of the green imagination only likes pristine forest and cannot settle anywhere else. It cannot breed anywhere else. Whereas the real spotted owl actually is perfectly happy. It can breed on second growth forest. Anyway, the spotted owl was one of the first examples of which there are many others. You know, you've got the snail darter, you've got the polar bear, and so on, of animals being used as poster children for green scaremongering campaigns. And what the spotted owl did was it was able to do was to have whole areas of the Pacific Northwest sequestered by environmentalists, logging industry closed down. And what was the result of all this? Well, the problem is that if forests are not maintained, what you get is this massive buildup of underbrush.
And they end up burning down.
That's right.
Happened in Big Bear. I remember it well. Yeah.
So there you are, you see. Forests are meant to be burned down cyclically, and that's good, and it's how they renew themselves and how you get new growth and stuff. But what happens when the forest is not cleared properly is you get, as you probably know, massive fires of which produce such enormous heat that it burns beneath the topsoil and it kills all the seeds underneath. So what you get is this wasteland. It always bemuses me the way that environmentalists, these guys who are supposed to care about nature and nurture it, these are the people who are doing the worst environmental damage. And we can talk about forests, we can talk about wind farms, wind turbines, which are destroying the landscape.
You mean the guillotines for birds?
Yeah. Well, I call them bat chomping, bird slicing eco crucifixes. They cause tremendous damage, and you have this perverse situation where you've got organizations like the Audubon Society and various other conservation bodies arguing for wind turbines because renewable energy is good supposedly, and supposedly clean and supposedly free, none of which it is.
It's more expensive and it's harmful to all sorts of creatures. It has all sorts of side effects. You know, it's a myth. These are just big myths.
Yeah. I think, is it Mark Stein calls them Cuisinarts of the skies? It's awful and it depresses me because I genuinely do love nature. I'm never happier than when I'm swimming in a river or walking up a hillside. I was brought up as a kid. My dad used to take me on walks and teach me about the newts in the pond at the bottom of our garden, and I used to collect the newts and study the galls on oak leaves and learn that they were made by gall wasps. And this whole element of wondering nature and loving nature and appreciating it for its own sake seems to have almost vanished from people's childhoods these days. It seems that nature is now a vehicle for guilt about mankind. And I think that's a terrible achievement of the green movement.
Yeah. And it's a method of control. And that's the scariest thing about the environmental movement. I remember I had this one guest on, forgive me, I can't remember his name, but he was a Berkeley professor that was basically talking, you know, he was spewing all the Malthusian stuff. I had James Kunstler on recently. He's doing the same thing. And all of these people, when you get to the bottom line of the discussion is there are too many people. The population has to be reduced. And I keep wondering why they don't praise or welcome another genocidal maniac. You know, what we need is another Joseph Stalin or Chairman Mao if they want to get what they want. Those people were the great environmentalists, I would think. Yeah. They would believe that.
Well, scratch beneath the surface, and that is exactly what they want. You can see them yearning for some kind of eco-catastrophe, which will prove them all right. I think they genuinely think that overpopulation is a problem. I just don't buy into it at all. Apart from anything else, population is the acceleration in population is reducing. I think the global population will probably peak at about 9.5 billion.
But even if it doesn't, I mean, human beings are the ones who came along and solved so many of our problems. People are a resource. The environmental movement just looks at them as a cost. Everybody's a cost. You know, you're an unwelcome guest on Earth. If you're a person, you don't deserve to be here. But the reality is, people are resources.
Yeah, well, I agree. Well, that was always Julian Simon's line, and I think he's a hero, Julian Simon. It's Julian Simon and Norman Borlaug, I think, are heroes. You're familiar with Norman Borlaug, aren't you? The guy who, Norman Borlaug was the guy responsible for the Green Revolution. That's green as in the good sense of green. He was the guy that in the 1970s, when people like Paul Ehrlich were warning that writing books like The Population Bomb, warning that we were all going to outstrip our ability to feed ourselves and we were all going to die horribly by the 1980s. Well, that never happened.
The opposite happened. We're feeding ourselves too well.
exactly. Well, obesity is a far bigger problem than starvation, isn't it? Well, Norman Borlaug was the guy who fed the Indian subcontinent. He enabled the Indian subcontinent to feed itself by developing these new strains of short-stemmed wheat, which were more suited to the conditions there, and it increased productivity massively. Now, no one's heard of Norman Borlaug. Even you haven't heard of Norman Borlaug, and you're a kind of libertarian. But everyone's heard of Rachel Carson. She's got about 5 national parks named after her. She's got a Rachel Carson Day. It's a topsy-turvy world we live in, and the values are false values.
It really is amazing. It's just amazing that such myths can be perpetrated on the public. You know, it's just amazing. Yeah, it's incredible. Well, what else would you like people to know?
Well, that although I have this reputation among these greeners as this snarling big oil funded nature hater, the opposite is true. And if anyone listening to this show doubts the veracity of what I'm saying, just follow the links in my blogs, look up on the internet.
And give out your website if you would.
Oh, yeah. Well, my website is jamesdellingpole.com. It's James, DELINGPOLE.com. Just Google me. You can find lots of stuff I've written. And so I've written 2 books on this subject, The Little Green Book of Ecofascism and Watermelons. And I can so guarantee that they're a good read that if you don't like them, I'd almost be prepared to give you your money back if you can be bothered to write to me in the UK, which you probably can't. And anyway, you won't need to because they're great.
That's great. I love it. I love it. Well, James, thank you so much for joining us today and shining some light on. There's so much more to talk about, really. I mean, endless issue. There's just every day you turn on the news and there is some example of either what I call environmental racism. And by the way, we didn't get to talk about that, but let me just explain that. I had Thomas Sowell on one of my shows, and when I was talking to him, I just happened to coin that term, environmental racism, because you look at all these high-end areas like where I used to live in Newport Beach, California, where they dedicate these huge patches of open space. And all that does is make the real estate values skyrocket. So, you know, you basically, they keep certain types of people who can't afford the area anymore out. It would seem like if you wanted to be so liberal and welcoming and sharing, you would let people in. But what they do is they keep people out with this fake open space that's not even useful for anything. Nobody goes there. It's just dumb. It's crazy.
You're going to so love the book because a lot of this stuff's in there. And thanks for having me on your show, Jason. Yeah.
Well, good. James, thanks for joining us. And again, the website is jamesdellingpole.com or just Google his name. And that's DELINGPOLE. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us today for the Holistic Survival Show, protecting the people, places, and profits you care about in uncertain times. Be sure to listen to our Creating Wealth Show, which focuses on exploiting the financial and wealth creation opportunities in today's economy. Learn more at www.jasonhartman.com or search Jason Hartman on iTunes. This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company, offering very general guidelines and information. Opinions of guests are their own, and none of the content should be considered individual advice. If you require personalized advice, please consult an appropriate professional. Information deemed reliable, but not guaranteed.